I think I mentioned at the very beginning that I grew up with a sense of disentitlement coming from a family that we were all people of service. So we worked in factories, we car washes, we cleaned homes, and that's all I kind of thought that was afforded for Latinos. And so I have this sense of disentitlement still. And I think when you asked about what kind of advice would you give, teachers out there, and this goes for students and teachers, don't be scared. Dream really big. I think that for some reason we're always scared to, and people have always warned us about, like, if you dream too big, you're just going to disappoint yourself. But how are you, if you don't try, I think that's the bigger disappointment. So to anybody out there, all the teachers, and if you feel like you have a book and you have a story to tell, please share that with us, because we need everybody's voice, and nobody's voice matters more than anybody else's. We're all equal, and there's room for everybody's stories out there. So just put it out there, and I think you'd be surprised.
Welcome back to Chalk and Ink, the podcast for teachers who write and writers who teach. I'm your host, Kate Narita, author of 100 Bugs, a Counting Book, and Fourth Grade Teacher. Today's interview with Ernesto Cisneros, middle school teacher and novelist, will fill you with hope, just like his novel, Ephraim Divided. Ernesto talks about opening the door to the Latino culture, how his students are a key component to his publishing success, and how students and teachers need to dream big because the world needs all of our stories. Preparados? Listos? Ya! Hi, Ernesto. Welcome to Chalk and Ink. I am so excited to be here with you today.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. Thank you so much for extending this invitation. Really appreciate it.
And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. So I was hoping you could start off by telling everyone about who you are as a teacher and who you are as a writer.
Definitely. It's kind of funny. If you would have asked me the same question a couple of years ago, I think the answer would have been different, because I thought of myself as being a teacher, kind of a teacher by day and an author by night. And now those two worlds have come in, they've joined forces, and so it's a little bit different now. The one thing that's definitely the same with both of them is that I wanted to give back to the same community where I grew up. And so where I teach right now, it's called Mendez Fundamental in Santa Ana. And it was a space saver school. And it's actually built right behind what used to be a Montgomery Ward's. There used to be a Newberry store there. That's right. It would be comparable to like a Big Lots or a Pick and Save or something like that. And I grew up there. I learned how to ride my bike there. I learned how to drive my car in the same neighborhood. And so I always grew up there, and I knew that I wanted to give back to the community. And now as an author, I get to do the same thing. And I get to meet kids from Santa Ana as an author, and I get to meet them as a teacher. So it's like the best of both worlds. And it's incredibly rewarding.
It is incredibly rewarding. So could you please talk about how the two worlds merged for you?
Yes. So I, a long time ago, I wanted to be a screenwriter. And so I remember going to Hollywood for a little bit with a little bit of a dream, and I became very disillusioned with the industry. People weren't very nice, and I came back, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I started substituting and became a substitute teacher, and the principals would come up to me and say, "Wow, you really connect with the kids. They really seem to respond to you. Have you ever thought about going to teaching?" And I started substituting, and I fell in love with it. And then as I was teaching writing to the children, I realized that I really enjoyed it. And the kids really kind of connected, because I think in order to teach something as a teacher, you have to have a passion for it. And I always had a passion for that. And so over the years, I would, demonstrate how the writing process with the students, and the students would really respond to my stories, and they started telling me that I should publish my stories. So they're actually the ones that kind of encouraged me to do this. And growing up, I grew up with a sense of disentitlement, like I'm from Santa Ana, I'm a Latino, and these opportunities are not afforded for people like me. At least that's what I thought at the time. And so I wanted to show the kids that, you know what, dream big. And so when I started writing, trying to be a role model for them and showing them that you can dream big, but I never really expected it to happen, to ever be able to publish a book. And then after 14 years of trying, you know, I had pretty much given up, but I knew that my students were watching. And they'd ask me, so did you write anything over the weekend? And I couldn't disappoint them. So I kept going at it. And then Effort and Divided came about. I wrote it for them because of everything that was going on during the elections and all the things that the media was saying about Latinos. And so I just wrote it. I never thought the book was going to be published. I thought I was going to be printing it out or having it in PDFs and sharing it with my students. And I really thought that was going to be the end of that. It was written just for them and for my kids at home. And they loved it. And they were telling me, no, you got to publish it. And I'm like, okay, let's try. So I called my agent. I said, well, I wrote this little story. It's a really quiet story. I don't think there's really a market for it, especially with the way things are right now. And my agent fell in love with the book and started submitting it. And 2 weeks later, we had an offer from HarperCollins, one of the big five publishers in the world. And so it's just kind of funny how my writing has fed my teaching, and my teaching has always fed my writing as well. So it's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I have a lot I want to follow up on there. I have to say that for me, what strikes me most about Effort and Divided is it's so honest. From your dedication, where you talk about your children on the first page, to the struggles that Effort faces, to the depressed teacher who's forgotten why he teaches, to Effort's realization that his family's much, much better off than the families in Tijuana, to Efren questioning why we accept children in cages but not chickens, and then in your acknowledgments you talk about, you know, as you just mentioned, almost giving up on your dream of ever seeing your work published. And I find that this kind of honesty in a novel, it's rare, and so I want to thank you for that. It's such a tremendous gift that you've given all of us.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate that.
You're welcome. So you talk about this a little bit, but what came first for you, the passion for teaching or the passion for writing?
You know, that's a question that I've been kind of thinking about recently. And I started wondering, like, at what point did I want to be a teacher? And looking back, I remember I had Miss Suter, I believe that was her name, and she was a teacher at Fremont Elementary. And she wasn't actually my teacher, but for some reason, I think she was in the classroom next door. And sometimes I would finish my work early, and my other teacher would kind of say, well, do you want to help other kids? And anyways, I remember going back. I was in second grade, and I would go during the summers, and I would go over there and I would help her out in the classroom. And so when I think back, I think I've always wanted to be a teacher, but I've also always enjoyed storytelling. I was that kid in the back of the class that I was always daydreaming. And so I was never the best student, but I was always daydreaming. So I guess I was always writing too. And I'm not sure. I guess if you want to consider daydreaming writing, I suppose I've always been writing. And if you want to consider the fact that I was helping my peers and going in the summers, because, you know, when you're a kid and before we had internet and things like that, you know, my parents were working, so I was pretty much at home, and, you know, it's not like we can take vacations or anything like that. So I was kind of bored at home, and so I enjoyed going back to school and helping the small kids. So I've always been kind of writing in that way and always been teaching. So it's just kind of been very natural. So I guess to answer your question, I think it's a little bit of both. Yeah.
That's an amazing story. I find so often that people do find that their passion for teaching and writing kind of intertwine in and out, you know, throughout their lives with one another. What an amazing experience that you were helping the kids while you were a kid at your school. Did they do that often, or were you the only peer doing that?
You know, a lot of my memories of that age, they're a little fuzzy now. It's just a couple of little snapshots that I have. I think it was mostly because I would finish my work kind of quickly. And, you know, sometimes as a teacher, you know, what do you do with those kids who finish early? And I think it was a little bit of just, you know, finding something for me to do. and also kind of, you know, it's, I think it's also about giving back too. And I think the teacher probably understood that as well.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think that what your teachers did there was amazing. I remember in fourth grade, I often finished my work early, and whenever we finished early, we played the card game Skip-Bo. So what I remember most about fourth grade is playing Skip-Bo, and it would have been a much, it would have been a much better memory, I think, to have a memory of being able to help others than playing Skip-Bo. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like to play Skip-Bo, but I don't know. There's so much more to life than playing games.
Yeah, and it's funny because it must have been memorable moments for me, because I remember the smell of the paste to this day. And I remember opening up the milks. I remember walking the kids over to lunch. I remember having a little can where we had to collect the quarters, the 25 cents for the milks and everything. And so, there's definitely a lot of great moments that I have from back then.
That's incredible. That sense of smell, I think, is something that can take people back to a memory that they didn't even realize they had.
Definitely. And that, and remember, I don't know if you ever done like the home, making your own Play-Doh, and, you know, and just the, just different things like that, all those little memories that you make. I mean, those are the big takeaways. So that's actually really influenced the way that I teach, which kind of ties into the writing, because as an author, you get a different perspective of teaching. And I get to learn that it's not really so much about the curriculum. So the curriculum that I teach now is really different from before. Before, I would use the Basel readers, and it was exclusively, you know, let the book, the manual, dictate what I taught. And now I barely use the Basel readers anymore. I'd rather use, real literature and as the basis for what I'm teaching.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's so important. So could you talk some more about that? So how does your writing affect your teaching?
Well, the writing is kind of, to me, writing is more about life and memories and connections. And before, with teaching, it was all about, like I said, it was all about the curriculum. And I really, you know, it's like when I go back and I really reflect about the material that I use in my stories, where does it come from? And it's memories, and it's memories that I hold dear to me. So the smell, and the, I hate to say this, but the taste of paste, because sometimes you would, you would lick your fingers. So I actually remember that too. And, and the smell of crayons, and there's certain things you just can't erase. And there's a reason why we hold on to those memories. And as an author, I realize that I don't have any memories about the curriculum. I don't remember the teacher giving us, I mean, I remember sentence strips, but I don't remember what we did with them or what I learned that day. But yet I remember, going to the lunch lines. I remember playing in the swings and, trying to figure out how high we could go and who could jump off the swing and land the furthest away. I remember after the rain, we would just go to the balancing beam. And then we try and push each other off, and just coming to class all full of mud. And those are the memories that I cherish. And so as an author, I realized that there's a lot more that we need to teach in the classroom. And we need to pretty much teach the entire child and not necessarily a particular curriculum or a subject.
That is extremely well said. I think what you just said is so important. It is not about the curriculum. It is about the entire child. And it is about making a connection with each child. And I think if we don't do that as educators, it doesn't matter what the curriculum is, because they're not going to learn it, because they won't be invested. If we want our students to be invested in what we're teaching, we have to be invested in the students.
Exactly. Exactly. And once you have that connection, I mean, the teachers that I always connected with were the ones that I always wanted to make proud. Those are the ones that I stayed for. And the other ones I didn't have connections with, I really didn't work that hard for them. That when you make a connection with the teacher, they become more of your mentor. And you learn so much more that way.
I completely agree. So how does your teaching affect your writing?
Well, it impacts me a lot, actually, because my classroom, it's funny, the last couple of years, especially once I sold the book, there was a lot more buy-in with the students. It's like, oh, he's a published author, and they bring it up a lot. They like to tease me about that too. And so I would say something about writing, and now I see that they would be a lot more open to it. Like they see, well, this guy actually has something to say. But I think the most powerful thing about being a teacher and an author is that I have a special connection with the kids. I get to hear them interact in a way that most people don't. And hopefully it comes across in the writing, but I'll be sitting, at my desk or something, and I'll have the kids just, they'll be talking or something, and I'll hear something. And I'm like, and I'll interrupt them sometimes. And I'm like, wait, excuse me, what did you just say? And sometimes they think that they're in trouble. I'm like, no, you're not in trouble. I just really want to know what you said, because that was fascinating, or the way you said that. What does that word mean? And so they're always, giving me definitions. It's like, oh, Mr. C, like just the other, right before the break, a kid wrote, oh, that's POG on the chat, on Zoom. And I'm like, what's POG? Exactly. And it stems from a video game. And again, I had to ask the students, what is this? And it just means that something's really great. It's a play of the game. So they're using it as, oh, that was like the play of the game, something that, was really great, a big moment. And so they're always keeping me young. And also some of the students, the ones that really like to read, they're my editors. I give them my work, and they go through there, and all the things that I teach them. So I teach them how to do peer editing, and they do that with me. And they correct my work, and they critique it, and they give me suggestions. They let me know when something's a little dull, and they're brutally honest, which is the best part. So it's almost like they're like my secret weapon to publishing books. I can actually talk to them about it and ask them. I can brainstorm with them. And in return, I think they get to see the world of publishing through a very real lens too. They get to see what it entails to write a book. And hopefully they feel motivated and inspired that maybe they'll be able to do the same thing someday.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, what you said there is so important on so many different levels. I found the same thing, that my students are more open to them when I'm critiquing their writing. They're more open because they know that I also get my writing critiqued. And that's awesome that you say that your students are your secret weapon in the publishing world.
They are. And, it's like I'll be sitting at some, they like to come to my, when we were in the classroom, they like during nutrition, they like to just stop by and visit. And sometimes all the noise, sometimes they like to have a little bit of a moment to myself, but I've always let them come in. And I can't help but listen. And I kind of feed off their energy. And sometimes I can see like scenes happening right there in front of me. There's times when I'm trying to come up with a name for a character. And so I just kind of look up in the room and I see who's there. And I'm like, would any of these names work here today? I have a character whose name is Dos Equis. And it stems from one of the kids in my classroom. His name was Alexander, but it was spelled with two X's.
I love it.
And so one day I just called him, oh, Alexander. I had two Alexanders in the class. I'm like, I'm going to call you Alexander Dos Equis. And I didn't think about the whole connection with the beer that came later. I probably wouldn't have said if I would have thought about that, but it just kind of stuck. And we went. I told the kids about a book signing at the Santa Ana Public Library, and he showed up and he brought his dad, and so I accidentally just let it slip, Dos Equis, and his dad felt he associated with the beer, and he thought it was hilarious, and so to this day, people call him Dos Equis.
I love it.
That's fantastic. And it became, and he's a character in my book.
Oh my gosh, that's so much fun. So tell us about a breakthrough moment you had in your writing.
Oh, okay. Well, like I mentioned, I've been trying to write for over 14 years. I wasn't having too much success. And something that I finally learned was that I needed to have a little bit more confidence in myself, and I needed to write from the heart and not use the mind so much. And what I mean by that is like, I would always get feedback from people and rejection letters, and they always give me recommendations. And I always tried to write what I thought other people wanted me to write. And it wasn't until I was really true to myself and I didn't write in, with the idea of this is going to an editor. I wrote with the idea of I'm going to just print this out and share it with my students. And I didn't follow any formulas. I didn't plan it out. I didn't think about repercussions of a scene and whether the scene goal was embedded. I just wrote the story that I wanted to tell. And I didn't think about, well, is this going to be something that's commercial enough? And all those little voices in the back of my head were silenced. And I was just, I just wrote the story that I wanted to read when I was a kid. The story that I never saw on the bookshelves. And I wanted, you know, I wasn't a very big reader because I never really connected with books growing up. And so, you know, I just wanted to share that with the kids and all the experiences that I had. And I wanted them to see the beauty of, you know, living in a Latino community. And that was my biggest takeaway. It was just, you know, my agent likes to call it underwear writing, where you pretty much just kind of bare everything and in your writing. And I think it's one of the most powerful types of writing. Because it really helps you to connect with the readers, and you know, when you read a book, it's almost like reading somebody's diary, and there's definitely a connection there with an author, and I think that if you're being genuine, you're being authentic, I think it really shows.
That is so powerful, connecting with your heart instead of your mind. And also having the confidence in yourself, right? The confidence to write what you wanted to write instead of what you thought other people thought you should be writing.
Yes. And like I said, this a story about an immigrant family. I never would have imagined that anybody would be interested in publishing that story because I hadn't really seen it. I hadn't seen it before. And there are other stories on there. It's just that, you know, Latino books just don't get the support from marketing, from publishers. They don't think that there's a demand for those books. And so they're not pushed. And so we don't hear about them.
Well, I feel like your book should be in every elementary classroom and upper elementary classroom. And I feel that strongly. I think, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, it's exceedingly honest. And I think we need more of that in literature and we need to see these stories. You know, I think that's why we have so much intolerance is that we don't view other people as having, you know, similar problems or issues that we have. And that's why we need literature to reflect everyone in our society because yes, there are differences in problems that people face, but there are also similarities. And it's through those similarities that we can connect to each other. And so if we don't have those windows into other cultures, we lose. And so I feel that we need more books that show, you know, different cultures that we don't see as much in literature.
Exactly. Yes. I think it's really easy to hate people or hate the people who you don't know. And it's a lot more difficult to dislike people once you get to know them. So that was definitely, you know, something that I think I wanted to also do, especially like in the rewrites, in the revisions that I had to do. Once I knew the book was actually going to be published, that was one of the things that was really important to me.
Could you talk more about that?
Which part in particular?
When you were doing the revisions, how did you focus in on that connection?
Well, one part with the book was really difficult was not letting what was happening in the media at the time impact the book. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to react to some of the. I wrote the book in 2016, and at a time where hate was given a national platform, and it mm-hmm. became socially acceptable for people to speak their minds, regardless of how hurtful the comments were. And I didn't want to address that. I wanted to focus on the positives. And so when I revisited the book. I also wanted it to be. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the window and mirror books.
Yes.
And I wanted to open the front door and invite everybody who didn't know a Latino family, immigrant family, to come over and visit my family. And I wanted them to get to know my family. And then if they wanted to still, you know, feel like they didn't want to be part of it, that's fine. That's their prerogative. I'm not going to be able to change their minds. But I wanted them to meet somebody, a real family, and not the stereotypes, and not to just, I guess, and I'm struggling here to articulate this a little bit better. But
I think you articulated it beautifully. That whole idea of you didn't want to go for a window, you wanted to open a door. That is phenomenal, right? I mean, and that's how we get to know one another, is by opening a door to our hearts. And that's what you did in this book.
Thank you. That sounded a lot better when you said it.
Okay, I always get teary during these podcasts, and I have to like take a minute to regroup myself. That's happening right now, in case you can't tell. Okay, so tell us about a breakthrough moment that you've had in your teaching.
You know, I think the biggest breakthrough I had was actually it impacted my teaching, but it came about from my parenting, and I think it was. When I first started teaching, especially when I started working like with honor students, I used to bombard them with homework. And I kind of subscribed to the whole philosophy of these kids have to be challenged, and, you know, we got to push them further, you know, so they could be more successful in life. And then I became a parent, and I started realizing that a lot of the homework was just taking up time from my students, from one, enjoying their lives and their time, and really connecting with their families, actually. And so I remember during when my kids got to junior middle school, I never saw them. They were always working on homework. And sometimes I'd want to work, you know, sometimes there'd be a project and we would do that together. So I tried to inject myself in their lives as much as I could. But I couldn't take my kids to go see museums. I couldn't do any of the enrichment things I wanted to do with my kids. And I felt like I missed out on those really important years. And I thought that was really tragic. And I was getting kind of upset at the teachers. And I was looking at the homework, and I'm like, but, you know, I had just answering more of the same question isn't really teaching the kids anything. A lot of it was busy work. And now I resent busy work now. And for the most part, I don't give homework anymore. And if I do give homework, sometimes it'll be like, okay, I want you to find an activity to go play a board game with your parents tonight. I want you to spend a little bit of time with your siblings. I want you to surprise your parents by cleaning some place of a portion of your home, but don't tell them you're doing that. Like maybe just wash the dishes, but don't say anything. And I just want to give them opportunities where they can connect with the family, and also to give them a chance to read. My own personal kids never got to read books. They couldn't enjoy them anymore because the teachers would give them so many worksheets to do. And so I think that was the most, that was my moment of awakening as a teacher. And I think that's when I really actually became a lot more successful with the students. Even with the Zoom lessons going on right now, I don't teach the entire time. I actually let my students go a little bit early. As it's more about the quality over quantity. And I try and do... to just really connect with the kids and make the lessons valuable to them and let them know why we're learning these things. So, I mean, I try to make grammar fun, for example. I love grammar. I love nerding out about grammar. And if I can get the kids to buy into that, to understand why it's important, they do that. Now we have like, you know, we'll be looking at something that somebody writes and they'll completely just start editing, and they go into these editing modes. And I love seeing that from them. It really just shows me, it's more of an authentic assessment to see them actually using the tools that I give them. And even in a selfish way, they do that with me. Like I said, I do share my work with them. And they're the ones who are telling me, Mr. C, really? A semicolon here? You know, Mr. C, it's destroying the voice in this paragraph. No, you got to get rid of it. It's too formal. Or Mr. C, how many M dashes are you planning on using on this page? Seriously. And that's when I know I got them. So I think parenting has really, really helped, because it's, again, I don't use the curriculum necessarily that the district always gives me. I love using literature. I love doing anything that's going to afford them a little bit more opportunity to discover things on their own. And it might not be my class. There's kids in there who love robotics and they love coding. And maybe language arts isn't going to be part of their life or something that they really, you know, writing books isn't something they're going to pursue. But coding is. So I want to make sure they have time to go ahead and pursue those things as well.
That is a beautiful answer. And I will admit that is one of my huge defects as a person. And not even, I can't even say as a teacher, but as a person, as a teacher and a parent is always, I always have to rein back my desire to do more and demand more. It's something I'm definitely more aware of. And I have this fantastic teammate who's always like, we need to pull back. We need to pull back. But I love what you were saying about those homework assignments to play a family game or, you know, do the dishes or spend time with your siblings. I think I might have to work those into our rotation. So thanks for that amazing tip.
Anytime.
I'm sure all the parents and my students will be really thankful as well. So how do you balance, you know, teaching and writing and parenting? You've got two teenagers at home. That is a huge, that's three, you know, three major things that you're balancing in your life.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's very, it's about priorities. And I think the trick is to figure out a way to find the time to do things together. Because I always, I was told by, I've heard a few authors who always say that they have moments where they schedule their writing time and they tell their families not to interrupt them during those, it's almost like if they're office hours and they're away at work. But I always refuse to do that because, you know, life doesn't work that way. And if your kids need you, they want to talk to you. You know, to me, they come first. And so balancing them is really tricky. But what I learned was it's not about doing things with the kids sometimes. Jumping in the gun a little bit in my explanation here. But for example, there's things that need to be done, like washing the dishes. And I think the biggest trick that I learned was the key is that I want to spend time with my kids and my family as much as possible. And I don't want to lock myself in my room writing during the times when I should be. I'm going to be missing out on their lives. But something as simple as just washing the dishes. You know, I can go over there and wash the dishes with my kids, and that's fun. And we get to talk, and you make it, and you have a moment there. And then once we're done with that, you know, they're my kids are teenagers, and they want to have their own time too. And so then I'm okay with it. So then we finish the dishes and, you know, we have an hour before dinner and they go to their room. And I know that at that point they want a little bit of, you know, their own time. And so that's a perfect time for me to go ahead and sneak into and do an hour of writing. I think before I used to have this vision that in order to write a book, I had to have the lighting had to be just perfect. I had to have exactly the right snack with me. I had to have my writer's hat that was, you know, God knows the last time I washed that thing. I had to have my lucky pens. Everything had, you know, the moon had to be in just the right place in the sky for me to write. And I realized that I just don't have those luxuries anymore. And so, you know, nor do I care to have them either. So now if I have half an hour here, I'll write for half an hour. And if I don't get to it, I'm not going to hate myself. I've also learned that when I'm washing the dishes with my kids, that's actually part of my writing process, because it's almost like there's this, the universe gives you this karma. And when you go out and you live life and you experience it to the fullest, karma likes to reward you as an author by giving you writing material. So then the next time I'm looking for an interaction with two characters, I'm going to go over there, I'm going to write about them washing the dishes and, you know, and them splashing each other. And for example, one of my kids likes to say when we have a policy in the house that we leave the knives in this little basket on the side. And my Abby told me, she just shouted out, all right, guys, this is the second attempt of my life this week because somebody left the knife inside the sink. And just little things like that. And that's where you get material from. So I think with finding time to write, I just feel like the more time you spend living, the writing thing just kind of happens on its own. I don't know. I guess that's not the best answer for you. It's just, and I guess you have to just enjoy them and be in the moment for when they all happen. You never know when your kids want to be around you. And you, when that opportunity comes, it's like a teachable moment, except it's a little different. There's a moment where the computer will call to you and you're able to spend 1 or 2 hours writing, and that's going to be magical. And there's going to be times when your students ask you a question in the middle of the class, and they're actually engaged and they want to learn, and they ask you a grammar question. You're like, oh my gosh, I have their attention. Let me go ahead and teach them. And then you have the same thing with your kids, and it's just it's about just balancing them and being in the moment for all three. And I know that's difficult, but I don't know. That's why I wish I could tell you that I have this, you know, this trick about having a magical schedule and getting up in the morning. But the truth is, I have a hard time getting up in the mornings. Staying up late. Well, I don't do very well when I stay up late anymore. I'm a little too old for that. So yeah, that's the best advice. Just be in the moment and just know that everything, you know, kind of works out. Sorry.
No, that's a great answer. I mean, being in the moment, but also you said not hating yourself. All right. And you also said letting go of perfection, of this idea that it has to be a certain way in order for you to write. And that's not true.
It's not easy. It's definitely, that's been a challenge. Nowadays, I usually kind of rotate my little thing. So I do kind of try to hold on to like a pen that I use, or, you know, like I said, I still have my writer's hat that I try and use. So when the writing isn't flowing and I do have a moment, I do put on my hat, and that kind of lets me know, okay, this is the writing, the author's mode that I had to go into. And having these little, I don't want to call them superstitions, or just these little knickknacks, but they connect you. So like one of the things I used to do was, a friend of mine gave me a candle. And she told me, turn it on every time you write. And that way, when you turn it on, your mind will know that, okay, it's time to write. And I do that. And these things work for a while, but I have to rotate them too. So one day it'll be that. Another day it'll be having nachos when I write. But then I start gaining weight, and I realize I can't do this. I can't be writing with nachos every single time. It's not healthy. So.
Do your students know you have a writing hat?
You know, I've never taken to school, but I did show it to them one time, and when I was doing my book launch, and I did talk to them about that a little bit, especially when I talked to them about having a little nook for themselves where they could study and making a place where they feel comfortable. And for example, right now during the Zooms, I have kids that I have two kids that actually followed my advice, and they don't turn on their cameras, but I they told me that they don't have a quiet place to go to, so I told them to go get one of those fuzzy, you know, the fuzziest blanket they could find, take it to the bathroom, put it in the bathtub, get a pillow, and that's their desk now. Just like Efren, yes. In fact, right now, my desk is actually inside of my closet. I pushed my closet aside, and I went to the container store, and I just have a makeshift desk inside of the closet. And so you make do with, you know, and it's almost like the less you have, the more creative you need to be. And it works for me, though. I'm happy here.
You know, I find that so true. When I think about how much time I wasted before I had my kids, I can't believe it. Versus now with kids, I'm like, okay.
Yes, the less time you have, the more productive you are, right?
Exactly. I find I'm much more productive when I have a lot of things going on in my life than, like, say, even over the summertime, right? And it's summertime, you would think that's when I'd be most productive because I'm not teaching. But that's not the case for me. I'm actually more productive during the school year.
Oh, my goodness. I hated myself after every summer because I always said, there's no excuse for you not to write a book right now or not to finish it. Forgiving yourself and knowing that, you know, that's part of the process. It also depends on what kind of book you're writing. And planning things out and having schedules, it doesn't work for every type of writing.
No, it doesn't. And sometimes you just need downtime, as you said. And as you've also said, that downtime, in a way, is actually writing time because you're living your life and you're gathering material, and you never know when inspiration is going to strike.
Exactly.
So what advice do you have for teachers who want to write, who aren't writing, but they think it's something they want to do?
My first piece of advice would be to pursue it. My second thing is to, and here's something that I had to do. I wasn't a very good student growing up, and so I had tons of holes in my education. And part of my journey, and I can only speak for myself, but I had to take a long look in the mirror, and I needed to really evaluate where I was. Because, you know, if you're going to have dreams and expectations, you know, dreams, you have to kind of say, okay, I want to be an NBA player. Okay, so then I have to look in the mirror and say, okay, well, I'm 5'10". Okay, my odds of becoming an NBA player aren't that great, but it doesn't mean it's not possible. So then what am I doing about it? What am I doing to overcome these obstacles of being 5'10"? And so... With writing, I was horrible at grammar before. I didn't understand the rules, and that was the first thing I had to do. I had to start from, you know, a blank slate, and I just taught myself grammar really, really well. And the second thing is that I wasn't a reader, and I think that's one of the biggest things. As a teacher, anybody who wants to write, you have to read. And I think you also, and anybody who wants to write, even if they're not teachers, you also need to interact with kids. It's kind of hard. I read lots of books, you know, as much as possible. And many times there's a lot of books I don't connect with because I hear the author and I don't hear the child inside the author. And that's who I'm interested in reading when I'm reading kids' books. So for the teachers out there, there's organizations like the SCBWI that they can connect with. That's really where I learned the whole process. And there's things that I think that you can't teach writing. Anybody can learn how to write, but you can't teach the desire to want to write. And that's the thing about going to the MBA. If you have that drive, I believe just about anybody, if you really, really have that drive, you can make it to the MBA. But are you pretty much going to all the work, you know, are you doing all the camps? Are you practicing day and night? Are you, you know, eating healthy? Are you reading up? Are you educating yourself? Are you, you know, doing everything that you can to get to that point? And so it's a little bit of a balance. But I think the biggest advice I would have is, again, write what you want to read. Picture yourself when you were 12 and the books that you connected to, and I would say write for that inner child inside of you. And if you write something that you're proud of, then other people will really connect to it too.
It's a beautiful answer. Thank you for that.
Sorry, it's a little long-winded, I thought.
No, it's not, you know, and I think what you said about putting in the work is so important. You mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, it was 14 years, and I had the same time frame. I wrote for 12 years before my first sale, and it was 14 years, you know, before the book came out, and I find myself in the same position. I haven't had a second sale, and I have to put that aside and just focus on the writing. And whether or not the second sale ever comes, sure. Do I hope it will? Yes, I do. But that's not really the point. The point is I love writing and I want to become a better writer. And the only way to do that is by writing and reading.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I have a little bit of a weird thing that I do where I don't finish all the books that I read. And I'm very picky and very selective about the books that I read. So for example, if I'm reading a book and this is happening with books that are like on the New York Times bestselling list, I'm like, oh my goodness, this book must be amazing. And I pick it up and I start reading it and I start noticing like bad habits or things that I'm not a big fan of. I stop reading the book because I don't want to pick up on these bad habits. And the books that I read, and I tend to reread books more than I do read books, like new ones. Because when I do find a book that I just really connect to, like, for example, there's a book called Operation Frog Effect. It's a middle grade book, and it's written through the point of view of 8 different characters. And each character is very unique and distinctive. And my second book is actually told in two different point of views. And I had to go back to that book, and I kept having to like take it apart, deconstruct the book, and figure out how is this author making every single character different. And so I'll read. It's one of my favorite books. It should have been on every list that when it came out, and it should have been covered with, you know, little emblems in the front cover. I'm kind of disappointed the book never got the attention it deserved. I'm moving. I think I lost the question there.
It doesn't matter. I've never heard of that book, so thank you. I'll put it on my list to read. I want to go back to something you said. So could you give me an example of a bad habit that will make you stop reading a book?
Okay. For when I write Latino characters, for example, I don't like when authors will have a character like a mom will come in and she'll say something in Spanish and then translate it into English. It sounds very artificial to me. And we don't do that. It's very unnatural. And I was very careful with Effort and Divide not to do that, for example. And so when I pick up another book, I just feel like it's something I don't want to incorporate into my writing. And I think that's the power about reading. When you read, we subconsciously pick up on the things that we like, and you pick up on things, and then they make their way into the stories. And I feel like if I continue reading the books, some of those bad habits are going to slip in there, and I'm going to pick up on those too. So I always try and just continue reading, and again, if I'm trying to always, I'm always on the lookout for another book that's going to be teaching me something new. And when I find those, those are the books that are magical. Poet X, oh my gosh, talk about powerful. That's a book that I'm going to be trying to deconstruct for the next couple of years, especially as I move on to YA books. Such an amazing book. Books that I always go, Gabby, A Girl in Pieces. It's YA. It's not really appropriate for middle grade kids. But, I think it is for the right middle grade kids. I'm sorry. I always, once I start answering the questions, my mind just keeps, it's part of, I have ADD, and I always tell people that I used to think of it as a hindrance. And now I think of it as a superpower. But when I do little interviews like this, sometimes my mind just, it races all over the place.
No, that's great. So I know about Poet X, but could you say the other title, Gabby Growing A?
Gabby, A Girl in Pieces.
Okay, thank you. Okay. All right. It's
probably what I would consider, I think it's probably my favorite YA book of all time.
Oh, okay.
Just because if you ever want to do, The kids that I teach, the Latino kids, are always looking for that authentic voice. I think, you know, you said that that's one thing you liked about the my book, and that's something that I look I really like about books too. So Gabby, A Girl in Pieces, like, it's actually written like a diary, but it reads like, I always tell people, it reads like if I'm reading my older sister's diary, which, okay, I hate to admit that I actually did when I was in middle school, but she's forgiven me, so it's okay now. There's other books, like, you know, when I have the reluctant readers in my classroom, and sometimes they want to read, like, there's one called Yaqui Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass.
Yeah.
When I listen to that one, it's just like, oh my gosh, these are the kids in my classroom, and the kids really identify with them, and they're like, wow, I see myself in the book. These are the books that disappear off my shelves because the kids, sometimes they don't give them back. And I'm more than happy to purchase more and more of these books. One, it supports the authors that I really, value. And two, that means that these kids are probably going to be, they want to reread the books too at home.
Yeah, that happens to me. There are certain books that they don't come back, and I'll have other people be like, do you have that book? And I'll be like, well, I used to.
yes. That's one of my dreams, that my book will be stolen frequently in classrooms.
I think it will. what's one writing exercise or activity that you can share with our listeners that you found is powerful in your own classroom?
One thing that with classroom work, or with like looking at assessing, analyzing literature, or
whatever you want to talk about, whatever you think that's something that you do that you think would help other teachers be better teachers.
Oh, okay. Well, one thing I don't do is I don't do, like with when the students will write essays or they do short stories or anything like that, I don't take them home and I don't read them there. Because by the time I give them back to the kids, I feel like the kids have already moved on. And I feel like all the feedback needs to be a little bit more immediate. And so I do something that's, well, I'm not sure how controversial it would be, but it's a little bit different. And my principals have all been very supportive of this. But I used to give the kids kind of like busy work. And then I would try and do one-on-one writer, a sit-down with the students, like a writer's workshop. One-on-one while the kids were doing the work. But then I realized that the kids weren't really doing work. And so what I started doing was I would create these templates of the hero's journey. And I would kind of walk the kids through them. And then I would assign them to analyze films. For example, you know, and when I was in college, we had to use Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And we had to watch Star Wars and dissect the movie and find all the different points, elements in there. I do that with Finding Nemo. I think that one works fantastic, and the kids love doing this. And so I think that they're getting a little bit more out of that by analyzing movies. And then I feel like they'll be doing that naturally after they start watching other movies too. And so while the kids are watching the movies, I'll sit down and I'll call one student at a time. And it takes me about 3-4 days before I get through the whole class. But I give the kids immediate feedback. And I found that having that one-on-one, the kids understand what my comments are. They're not just kind of reading them on the margins. And they get to ask me questions back. I get to give them suggestions. We go over strategies that might help them. And I can kind of cater the instruction to every student. So if I know that I have a student that's, you know, struggling with the, you know, sentence structure and somebody who's not very fluent in the language, I'm going to be going for the content and I'm not so worried about the language because that will come in time. And if I have another student who's just prolific and it's just like, I mean, I have students that have written things that I feel like, oh my goodness, it's way better than my stuff. I always try and find something that we can improve on. And so I just feel that working one-on-one like that, you cater the instruction. So that's one thing that I've always just really found. And when we do work on writing, this is a little tip that it took me many, many years to learn. You can't read everything. And so I don't look for everything. So if we're writing argumentative essays, I might look for something like we use a strategy called TPAC, which focuses on textual evidence. And so I'm only going to read the body of the essay because that's all I'm looking for. Or maybe the lesson for the day is going to be on transitions or academic language. So when I look at the essay, I'm only looking at the transitions. And that's all I'm looking for. Maybe we're looking at how to start up an essay and having a thesis statement. So instead of reading the whole essay or even assigning the whole essay, many times I just assign parts of the essays too. Because as a teacher, I have 130 something students. I can't as a teacher, I can't do a good job if I haven't slept because I'm trying to get through all these essays. So I always, whatever the focus is on during of that week, that's the only thing that I correct.
Wow, that's really powerful. That's amazing that your administration lets you, you know, use the movies tied in with the hero journey while you conference.
Well, it's yes. And the thing is, you know, they're getting curriculum that I received when I was, you know, I was also a film major in college. So, you know, to me, it's really valuable too. And I think that you can definitely use short stories. You can use movies just as well as a book in the classroom.
Definitely. And I think what you said about teaching parts of an essay is really powerful. I found that as well in my classroom, just looking at someone's thesis statement or just looking at textual evidence, because you're right. You cannot spend your whole time looking at a complete piece of writing. That's really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the year, we mostly write pieces of essays. And then, and of course, like at the end, when I want to do the full assessments, that's when we'll go ahead. And you know what? And we also have to have different types of writing. We have to have writing that isn't critiqued, that writing that's shared, some that's private. We have to have different, you know, opportunities for the kids. So can you imagine if a teacher went through and corrected everything you wrote? You probably would never want to write again, which is kind of what happened to me when I was a kid.
No, I think that's true. So do your kids have a writer's notebook?
Not right now, because we're in the pandemic. So right now, everything's completely changed. But yes, I used to give them the composition books, and I would always encourage them to walk around with them. And right now, I have a little list of students, former students, who send me pages because they want to become writers too. And I told them, it doesn't matter if I taught you back when you were in second grade, and let's see, what year would it have been, 2003, and you write something, send it to me. I'll still look at it. So every once in a while, I check my emails, and I'll get former students who are sending me work. 2 weeks ago, I had a student from graduate school who was doing his turning in his book reviews. Movie reviews to the professor, and the professor was not very nice about his comments, and the student was a little devastated. So I had to go back and kind of basically give a tutorial to my student. So he reached out to me saying he was really struggling with his writing, and he needed some help. And you know, this is a student that he's in college now, and I taught him back in seventh grade, and he was reaching out to me for help. So it's kind of cool.
That's amazing. What a testament to your teaching.
Well, it's not so much the teaching, it's the connections. You know, it's like it's just like with everything. I'm not the best teacher in the world. I'm not the best writer in the world. But when you just be in the moment and connect with people, you know, things just kind of work out that way. My students know some of my lessons are just a mess sometimes, and they're okay with that. I used to think that, like, for example, this week we're doing, we did just finish semicolons, and I was trying to, you know, I don't want them to just know how to use a semicolon. I want them to know why and when and how do things change, and using an em dash and a colon, and okay, so, you know, like when you have too many commas in a list, you can overwrite a comma with a semicolon, and I'm like, okay, but what impact does it have? Should we use an em dash here? And we have these conversations in there. I call it nerding out because it's kind of, you know, it's kind of nerdy, but the kids really seem to respond to that. And you know, it's once you have the buy-in, it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, teaching is connecting. The best teachers are the ones who connect. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going back, sorry, where I was heading with that was that they need to see your imperfections too, and I don't hide those from the students. So another little trick for the teachers is you want your students to see you fail. So when I give them little sample sentences, I don't know if this happens to you, but I'll be doing I'm like, all right, let's come up with a sentence, an example of this. I used to actually put that in my lesson plans, and I would write the paragraph the night before. And then, of course, I'd feel like, oh, that's a horrible paragraph. Let me clean it up. Let me polish it. And I would try and come up with this example. And then what ends up happening is that you just intimidate the students. And they think that you're this really amazing author, and that they can't do the same thing. So I stopped doing that. And sometimes I'll come up with examples or really, and I call them the brain fart moments when you just can't think. And they see me. They see that happen. They see me blank out like I've been doing during this interview. And I'm okay with that. I want you to know that, you know, I make mistakes and my mind wanders, and that sometimes I have to regroup, or I might have to ask the person interviewing me, I'm sorry, could you tell me what the question was again? And that's part of the process. And when they see that you're not perfect, you know, they're okay not being perfect too. And that's crucial too.
It is. I make mistakes every day in my classroom. So I teach fourth grade, and I have to teach every subject matter. And so
ooh, I remember those days. That is tough. And I commend you. Elementary, oh my gosh, you do at least 50% more, you know, more work than middle school teachers. And I know middle school teachers are going to probably resent me for saying that, but you just do. You're not just a teacher. You're also a parent. So you're like a foster parent as well. So it is, oh my gosh. I have so much respect for you as a middle elementary teacher.
Well, thanks. I feel that same way. I used to teach first grade, and I have to say teaching fourth grade is 50% of the work of teaching first grade. So I'm not surprised about you saying that with fourth grade and middle school. So yeah, my students absolutely love it when I make a mistake. They're like, no, Miss Narita, that's not true. And I'm like, okay, you're right. Tell me. And it's really great because I think that builds a level of trust in the classroom.
Yes, and it lets you know that they were listening.
That's also true. So this has been so much fun. Before we go, I was hoping that you could tell us about some books that you think every middle school classroom should have that you haven't written.
Yes, definitely. There's definitely one book in mind. If the teachers listening are middle grade teachers, actually, or higher or above too, the first book that comes to mind is Flying Lessons. It's an anthology by We Need Diverse Books, the organization founded to try and bring a little bit more diversity to the books that we're reading. And it is an amazing, amazing book. One of the stories in there, it's the one written by Meg Medina, you know, Mercy, yeah. Juarez Changes Gears. It actually started out as a short story, and that short story was part of the Flying Lessons anthology. And she liked the character so much, she decided to turn that into a book. And that book ended up winning the Newbery. So without Flying Lessons, she doesn't win the Newbery. We don't have Mercy in our lives. The other book is one that's going to be coming out. And this one's really interesting because it's very similar to Flying Lessons in the sense that it's an anthology. And I learned about this book today, actually, in the morning. And I was very surprised to learn that this book, it's going to be coming out in August of 2021, next year. It's called Living Beyond Borders, and it is actually the first children's anthology written exclusively by Latino, by Latinx authors. And I'm like, that cannot be right. And I started Googling and trying to find other anthologies, and I could not find any. So I'm really looking forward to that one. It's called Living Beyond Borders. The other previous book was called Flying Lessons. And I would really recommend teachers to spend some time looking at the Project Lit program, going to their website and looking at all the recommendations that they have. Because honestly, right now, most of the books in my queue that I'm wanting to read, they're mostly all the Project Lit books. And there's a book there for everybody. And talk about window books and mirror books and front door books and sliding door books or whatever you want to call them. I just think that we need a variety of books because you don't know which books children are going to identify with and connect to. And the more variety we have, the more kids are going to hook, and you're going to get them to love reading. And I think that reading is like one of the most powerful things anybody can do, because it's kind of like, you know, when we're born, we're not born with manuals. And to me, literature, that's what they are. They're like manuals for ourselves and how to live life and how to learn and grow.
That's really powerful. Could you talk more about Project Lit for people who don't know about it?
Yes. Project Lit. Oh my goodness. I could talk to you as a teacher, as an author, kind of both. Either way, I'm actually such a huge fan of it. And I'm actually kind of upset at myself that I didn't know about it a little bit before. I know that it started off as a grassroots movement, and it was basically, it's like a network. It's I know it's national, and I've been, it's funny, I've had so many, most of the people who've been reaching out to me has actually been through Project Lit. And what it is, it was a little movement to try and get the correct books into the hands of the students. They're a little bit more like culturally relevant books. They're more diverse. And quite honestly, there's a lot of kids out there, and especially if you're African American or Latino or any kind of minority, or like kids who are LGBTQ kids, they don't always see themselves and reflected in the books that they're reading. And that's why they aren't connecting. And a lot of times, our kids are not reading. And the books, if you look at them, they're so powerful on there. And that, yeah, if you just go ahead and just go to their main website, you'll see this beautiful banner that I'm looking forward to finding if I can get a poster of it. I actually
Yeah,
didn't
that's
send
very
them an
nice.
email. Yes, I want that poster. And it's basically, I think it's like every book that these books should be in every classroom. And
I
as a
agree.
teacher, I know a lot of teachers who are not readers. And the first thing is that it's when I was teaching elementary, I remember back in the day, I think this was like 2003 through 2004, my second graders were all about Pokemon. And in order to connect with them and to do a better job, I would go home and I would watch the Pokemon cartoons. And then, so then the next day in class, I could be doing math problems on the board and I'd be, all right, imagine that Pikachu has, and meets a friend. Okay, how many friends do you? And then I would create math problems using the cartoon characters. And I was kind of using that as a tool to learn. As a teacher, especially if you're teaching language arts, I don't see how you can preach to the kids that they should be reading if you're not reading as well. And I think that, I mean, there's nothing better than like, I use the term a lot, nerding out, but just talking about books. And this is the last thing. Sorry, I have to go back to this one. You asked me earlier on about tips for teachers.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing that I did learn, both that kind of connects my world as an author and as a teacher, is that I was trying to figure out why I didn't like reading and why I didn't pick up books. And one was, well, because I didn't see myself in them. But two is because it wasn't a shared experience. And what I mean by that is, here, let me ask you a question. What's the first thing you do when you go see a movie in the movie theater, back when we were able to? Like, as soon as you come out of the movie theater, what do you find yourself doing?
When I come out of the movie theater,
Yes.
I'm talking about the movie with the people I'm with.
Exactly. And when we read books and we go to libraries and we pick up books, what do we do when we finish the book?
We talk to our friends about it.
Ah, if your friends have read the same book though, right? But I don't know if you, my experience was that I didn't have anybody to talk to about the books that I was reading. And so I think that the beauty of going to the movies is being able to talk about the movies afterwards and sharing that experience with somebody else. And I think as a teacher, it sometimes we're missing out on the opportunity to connect with the kids. So when you do have a give a book and you take your class to the library, the teachers need to be spending some time checking out books as well, and give the kids an opportunity to talk about the books. And so I do the thing kind of like speed reading, but we do that with books, and we just kind of we spend an entire class day just talking about the books that we read from the library and why they're recommending them, and we make little thought bubbles and they go inside the books and we leave them in the library, and so people can look at the reviews that we've left. So you could pick up a book. You could pick up, for example, Poet X, which is one of the more popular books in my classroom, and people will leave their reviews in there. So when you go over there, you're like, oh, this book has a whole bunch of reviews from students, and then you could look, read them over, and see if that book's something that you're interested in. But giving the opportunity to kids to just talk, not using academic language, just having a real conversation about the books. That's it's really it's a huge benefit to the kids, and I think they really enjoy it. And I think those are the ones that become lifetime readers.
I have to follow up on a couple of things. So, how do your kids leave the reviews in the book with sticky notes?
Oh no, we have this. What I did was I created a template, and it's pretty much imagine a bookmark,
Okay.
and then it has like a thought bubble on top of it, and so the bookmark portion of it stays in the book. And as I use them in cardstock and yellow, and then I laminate them after the kids do them. So they do them on using Google Docs, and they go to the draw feature, and they make the little thought bubble on there, and they create them themselves. And then they just go ahead and they print them out. I laminate them, and then we go back to the library. We match them up with the books. And so our librarian has been really amazing because she discovered that these books had these little thought bubble bookmarks in them, and they had the review and their opinions on the summary on the back on the bookmark portion. And she started pulling out those books and she put them on top of on the shelves. So when you walk into our library, you see all the little things on there. And I believe I have a photo on my phone. I'm gonna send that to you.
I would love to see that. That sounds amazing. That's something I've been trying to figure out how to do, and I have been unsuccessful in the different methods that I've tried. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, and the librarian actually told me that. She says, you know, it's kind of funny, but all those books that have those little, you know, bookmark thought bubble, the reviews, the peer reviews, she says those are the ones that keep getting checked out because they call to people.
Yeah.
And I'll send that to you. I'll definitely share that with you.
Thank you so much. So I want to talk about Project Lit a little bit more. That's what I found out about Ephraim Divided. We've had a Project Lit book club in my school, myself and my teammate and my assistant principal. This is our third year doing the program. So I am so grateful for the program because it allows us to show our students a lot of windows that otherwise they wouldn't have, and also mm-hmm. get books into our classrooms that otherwise we wouldn't have. And I'm so grateful to my colleague because she is the one who chose your book for us to read this year.
Oh, I owe her a lot. Please thank her for me.
I will. So thank you. And I'm wondering, are you going to start a Project Lit book club chapter in your school, or has anyone else done that?
By the time that because of the pandemic, by the time I really learned about Project Lit, because honestly, I'm not sure when it actually started, but by the time I came to know about it, it was a little too late for me to do anything like that. But in the future, I definitely do want to do that.
Yeah, it's been really amazing. I mean, it kind of sounds like you already do so much with literature in your classroom, but one thing that I've liked about it is in our school, we do it with our fourth and fifth graders. And so it gives me a chance to get to know students who aren't in my classroom. So this year we're actually doing it. We're doing it virtually. So I'm teaching hybrid. So I'm actually teaching in school. I teach half my students on Monday and Tuesday, and then the other half on Thursday and Friday. And then Wednesday I teach everybody virtually. But so we are doing our club virtually this year. And I feel it's been actually much more powerful than it was in person because you're probably going to like, oh no, this is a horrible idea. Just to be transparent on my part, we actually require the kids to answer 5 questions before they come to the book club so that we know that they've read the books. And we haven't done that in the years past. And it's actually so much better this year because everyone's actually read the book. And we've just been having super powerful discussions with the kids, and it's been really fantastic this year. So I cannot wait to discuss your book. Your book is our February book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This project has been amazing for me too, because it's allowed me to reach out to a lot of and visit a lot of classrooms as well. I mean, they're definitely connecting me with a lot of classrooms that are reading my book, and which is really strange because it never really, when you hear from a classroom that's on the other side of the country and they're reading your book, it's just really surreal to find that. One of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of the program too, though, is that there's a lot of books, especially those written by minority groups, that unseen. They fall through the cracks, and Project Lit does an amazing job of highlighting those books that may otherwise not get any kind of recognition, and they're not going to be read, and now they do. So there's a lot of books that are kind of like quiet books, kind of little sleeper books like mine, and they're being highlighted and given a little bit more legs to run on.
I completely agree. Although your book is not a sleeper book. That's like twice you've called it that. You have to stop calling that. It's phenomenal. It's not quiet at all. It's, I don't know. It's like a hear me roar book. So it's not a quiet sleeper book. So, and the other great thing about Project Lit is actually one of the requirements is that each club has got to donate books to schools that might otherwise be what is called a book desert. So that is another great thing, is that not only are the kids discussing the books, but then each chapter is working to find a way to provide others who might not have access to these wonderful books.
Yeah, it's a great program for sure.
Well, Ernesto, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I so appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure was mine. Really, really grateful for this opportunity. Thank you so much. And when February comes around, please don't be shy about reaching out to me. And I'd love to connect with the students and answer questions or anything like that too. That would be amazing.
Oh, thank you. That would be an incredible experience. Thank you so much for offering that. You're so generous.
Oh no, this is a dream. I mean, this is, and part of the thing I need to do. And if there's any, are any students going to be listening to this?
I don't know if any students have been listening to it. We get about 25 downloads on average per episode. There's been one exception to that. I interviewed Melissa Stewart, who's a pretty famous nonfiction author, and she's got about 60 downloads for her episode. So I would love it. Are you going to share it with your students?
Yeah, no, I do. I always do. And I'll definitely, I'll put it on all the social media. I'll try and put it out there too. My question was just that, and I guess this would be kind of advice for teachers too. You know, one thing that I've been struggling with, and I still struggle, and it goes back to the little comment you said about my book, whether it's a sleeper or not. I think I mentioned at the very beginning that I grew up with a sense of disentitlement coming from, a family that we were all people of service. So we worked in factories, we car washes, we clean homes, and that's all I kind of thought that was afforded for Latinos. And so I have this sense of disentitlement still. And I think when you asked about what kind of advice would you give, teachers out there, and this goes for students and teachers, don't be scared to dream really big. I think that for some reason we're always scared to, and people have always warned us about, like, if you dream too big, you're just going to disappoint yourself. But how are you, if you don't try, I think that's the bigger disappointment. So to anybody out there, all the teachers, and if you feel like you have a book and you have a story to tell, please share that with us, because we need everybody's voice, and nobody's voice matters more than anybody else's. We're all equal, and there's room for everybody's stories out there. So just put it out there, and I think you'd be surprised by the response that you're going to get.
Well, thank you, Ernesto. With that, I'm going to end, because I cannot think of a more powerful way to end than with what you just said. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too now. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again on February 5th when Chalk and Ink talks with novelist and third grade teacher Jody Little. Looking forward to chatting with you again soon. Take care. Bye.